ExxonMobil's managers in Chad took justifiable pride in the $16 million in annual wages, training, education, and exposure to global norms in health and education that the corporation provided to the Chadians in its direct employ. The knock-on benefits of these improved lives would be substantial, if hardly enough to right Chad. Yet ExxonMobil considered the construction of deeper social and physical infrastructure in the country to lie outside of its responsibilities. That was why the corporation had so purposefully recruited the World Bank into the high-risk Chad oil project in the first place. When ministers in Chad's government, or local human rights activists, begged ExxonMobil to build a health clinic or lay a road, the corporation typically demurred, explaining that oil production was its core competency and that it intended to follow the letter of its contract. As oil production grew, and Idriss Déby did not become a better president, and Chad's social and health indicators failed to improve significantly, ExxonMobil's executives privately blamed the World Bank. The bank had simply not done what it promised to do when it endorsed and funded the 2000 plan to manage oil revenue for the greater good of Chadians, ExxonMobil's managers argued. There was some truth in their complaints. ExxonMobil operated on time and under budget in a way that a sprawling multinational bureaucracy, such as the World Bank, never could. The oil company's criticism assumed, however, that the experimental governance goals embraced by all of the project partners, including ExxonMobil, had been realistic in the first place. By 2006, this no longer seemed a defensible claim. Irving prided itself on its realism. The most honest assessment was that the two main parties to the Chadian oil project had always been ExxonMobil and its partners and shareholders on the other side, and Déby and his kleptocratic clansmen on the other. In Doba, the flat market town nearest to the oil fields, a revenue-sharing scheme supported by the bank endowed the local government with tens of millions of dollars. The political chiefs did build a school, but generally favored grandiose construction projects over health and education services. They spent $4.4 million on a soccer stadium in Doba that could seat 20,000, notwithstanding the lack of a professional soccer league of any significance. School, road, and hospital building projects went forward more encouragingly, but when they were finished, the buildings stood empty for lack of nurses, doctors, and teachers. Local construction budgets and expenditures were grossly inflated by the skyrocketing costs of materials and the large number of skimming hands involved. Unmowed grass soon bent like wheat across the soccer stadium's field. Young mothers in the area still died in childbirth at rates comparable with the era before oil. It's not easy to hide the sun with your hands. The money is there in large quantities, remarked Bukanibi Garka, a member of a national commission meant to help supervise oil revenue. But it is not being spent very well. As Idriss Déby's government grew wealthier, the president also became more vulnerable to mutiny. Like his acquaintance, Teodoro Obiang in Equatorial Guinea, Déby increasingly looked like a nervous dragon sitting on a pile of treasure waiting to be assaulted by coup makers. In 2003, Déby had pushed for alterations to the constitution that would allow him to become president for life, and he succeeded in abolishing term limits by 2005. A betrayal of Chad's shaky democratic parties that had further isolated Déby politically. He had come to power by force years earlier, backed by Sudan's secret police, and so it did not require a paranoid imagination to think that he might go out by a similar method. Sudan to the east was engulfed by violence in the province of Darfur, which bordered Chad. Marauding Arab militias loyal to President Omar al-Bashir waged a scorched-earth campaign through Darfur's villages and towns after 2003. At least 300,000 people died, and about 2.5 million fled their homes. About 240,000 Sudanese crossed the border into Chad and crowded into camps, where they were formally recognized by the United Nations as international refugees. At first, Déby tried to play a balancing role in the Darfur crisis, mediating between his former patron, President Bashir, and his newer patrons in Washington. By 2005, however, Déby perceived that the Darfur conflict might threaten his grip on power. Many of the non-Arab rebels battling Sudan's government belonged to Dabi's own Zaghawa tribe. Bashir had been urging Dabi to bring these rebels under control, to prove, in effect, that he was a friend of Sudan's. Suppressing the rebels was beyond Dabi's means, but in any event, he needed the Zaghawa networks for his own security. In 2005, he aligned himself with Khalil Ibrahim, the powerful Islamist leader of a Darfur rebel faction. Once he did that, Dabi made plain to Khartoum that he had changed sides, defaulting on his historical debts to President Bashir. In reply, Sudan's security services offered vengeful support to Mohamed Nouri, the head of a Chadian rebel group, the Front Uni pour le Changement, or the United Front for Change. Dabi picked up intelligence that a Nouri-led rebel invasion from Sudan's territory, for the purpose of removing him from power, could come at any time. Dabi's defenses to the east and around the capital were weak. His Ministry of Defense paid out about 70,000 salaries, but only about 20,000 of those soldiers possessed uniforms and occasionally turned up at their jobs, while only about 4,000 were armed, trained, and prepared for combat. Moreover, if Dabi ever ran out of the cash he required to pay his tens of thousands of ghost military salaries, he would invite mutiny. This threat was a constant drain on his cash flow. Mercenary Algerian, Ukrainian, and Mexican pilots on rotating contracts flew the ramshackle planes and helicopters in the president's tiny air force. The professional French-manned garrison and air force training mission at N'Djamena's international airport offered a much more convincing defensive deployment, but only if, in the heat of a crisis, the French government decided that it was in its interest to have its soldiers shoot at Dabi's enemies, a highly uncertain outcome.